This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We've heard a lot of competing ideas about the state of free speech. So to help me make some sense of it all, I reached out to J. Caspian Kang, author of The Loneliest Americans and a columnist for The New York Times. Jay often writes about issues of identity and the culture wars. And in a time where things are way too often made out to be cut and dried, Jay lives in a world of nuance, even when the issues affect him personally.
Right, when my book came out, there was a group of Asian American studies academics who all said, we refuse to read this book. Now, their reasons were like, you know, in my opinion, a little bit bizarre.
Right? Why'd they refuse?
Well, they said that, like, because part of my argument is that, like, well, Asian American is a pretty fraught term, and it's not really a political identity. And, it, like, there's a group of people, including Asian American studies professors, who believe that this is a real term. But in reality, most people don't think it's a real term, right? So they said, we refuse to read this book. It was maybe, like, five different people, you know? And then it got amplified to a point where everyone thought there was this huge backlash against this book,
right?
You know,
and it's five people.
And every interview that I did about this book for the first month was about this backlash to the book. And each time I would explain, look, I don't think this is a real backlash to the book. It's just Twitter. And, you know, there's no way for me to sort of express this in any sort of way outside, you know, because they would say, okay, but what about the backlash would be their next question, right?
Jay, we heard earlier in the program from Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez, and she pretty strongly made the argument that cancel culture is just an idea puffed up by powerful elements on the right to create a sense of grievance in their base, that in some sense the threat is just cooked up by reactionaries. What do you say to that?
Well, you know, I think that she is describing something that is real, you know, that there is a way in which these crises do get weaponized to create a sense of grievance. But what I don't understand is, you know, even if that is true, why that means that the only other option is for everybody to shut up about it and to just pretend like there isn't some sort of weight or some sort of pressure on people to not say the wrong things. And I think that by saying that there's no cancel culture, what you've actually done is you've made it impossible to talk about those people that you're concerned about on the left who are also being canceled. So then, like, you know, like what happens is that nobody cares about the people who are on the left who are being canceled, and everyone who's on the right or center right that's being canceled is then just told, well, we can't talk about it at all, you know? So then in the end, you just have a bunch of people who are not talking about something.
Now, as we speak, one of the big stories in the news, of course, is about Joe Rogan and Spotify. Several musicians yanked their music off of Spotify to protest Rogan's show, and folks on the right are calling this an affront and an effort to just cancel Rogan.
I do wonder why so much of our conversations around these questions these days are centered around basically asking tech companies to do something that tech companies don't want to do. You know, like Spotify just wants to make sure that that this goes away. And they're just going to do whatever it they can to make sure it goes away with the least amount of damage to them. Right. I think the the tenor of the conversation is to try and have Spotify dictate what is acceptable speech and what is not acceptable speech, right? And if you're, they're not asking the FCC to do something, right? They're not asking the government to do something. And I think that places these tech companies in this really sort of powerful role, right? Like they can be the people who are enacting a type of political reality. And I think that when you are going to a company that has never thought about these types of things, really, I don't know, I think that's somewhat delusional. And I think that when we're just trying to push for those types of decisions from these types of companies, we're just going to get, you know, things that are in the best interest of those companies in the end.
Now, Jay, I think you'll agree that one of the criticisms that's often lobbed at the idea of cancel culture is that, well, yeah, a lot of people are canceled and they end up, most of them, rebuilding their careers and they don't starve to death and they're just fine. You hear this on, I hear this quite a lot and I'm a little startled by it.
I don't know. I find that odd too, honestly. You know, like I was, Justine Sacco is the woman who tweeted that sort of her bad joke, you know, and racist joke about AIDS in Africa. And then she was hounded and she became like sort of one of the, I don't know, she was put on like the Mount Rushmore of like the canceled, right? And I just by random chance ended up doing an article about daily fantasy sports. And I reached out to the company, one of the companies, FanDuel, that is one of the big companies now in sports gambling. And their PR director was Justine Sacco, you know? And so in some ways, Justine Sacco is fine because Justine Sacco now has a job at this emerging, like, kind of cool company. But, you know, what I found through talking to Justine Sacco on and off for like 6 or 7 months is like you know, she's not fine. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, I don't know, like I was talking to her and I said, look, we have to mention this in the article that like you're this Justine Sacco, you know, and like the terror that I could see come across her face was like amazing, you know, like she's still scarred by this sort of thing. Yeah. And so I don't really believe the argument that everyone's fine after all these sorts of things. And I certainly don't understand it in the context of the prevailing idea that like online speech and online hate and online abuse leads to all these sorts of bad effects. Like, I don't think you can have those two ideas in your head at the same time.
How much does this permeate into life that's not the academy, that's not show business, that's not media, and so on and so forth? I talked earlier with a former college professor who made the assertion that for every high-profile cancellation, there are many, many more cancellations of people that we never hear about. You think that the average person walking down the street is affected by what's called the threat of cancel culture?
I mean, absent any real examples, I'm not sure what that would be. You know, like I do think it is mostly a media phenomenon
I have to say, it does, you see it, cancel culture became in the Trump rhetoric, like the first arrow out of his quiver at a certain point. The same with, you know, a trans swimmer at the University of Pennsylvania. Things that are really, really tiny in numbers became an electrifying part of the Trump appeal and are sure to be again. And you saw it again in the governor's race in Virginia. Oh, my God, critical race theory is infecting the school system. It wasn't even in the curriculum. It's very effective.
Yeah, I think that if these things were more commonplace, if they were everywhere, then those more commonplace examples would become the ones that were talked about, you know? Like, I don't think anyone on the right wants to use as their, you know, cause celeb, right? Like something that happened at Oberlin, right? And I think that if it was happening more to in the broader public, that certainly that those would be the examples that were amplified. Like, I think that by definition, almost, it's going to always be difficult to describe this thing. It's more of a feeling, right, that is out there amongst people than anything else. And when you try and the trick that I think a lot of progressives have figured out, and, you know, the sort of center progressives as well, is to basically just say that if it doesn't pass some sort of legal doctrine, then it's not real. Well, if the government isn't sort of putting you in jail, then that means that cancel culture isn't real, you know, where there's like a lot of missing internal links in that type of argument, right?
Now, I understand and share some of the concerns about ideological narrowness or intolerance on campus, and yet it doesn't seem to me near the threat to democracy posed by a lack of voting rights or the influence of dark money on elections and many other things. Or am I missing something?
No, I think you're right. And, you know, but I do think that
I mean, not to dismiss the things that do happen when they're wrong, but it seems inflated.
As somebody who, you know, does care pretty deeply about free speech issues, right? Like, the biggest threat to free speech, without question, is from right-wing state legislatures who are banning and making certain forms of protest illegal, right? Now, the question is really just, like, so how do you address that, right? Like, how, as people who are interested in free speech, how do you sort of fight that threat to democracy? And I do think that you have to basically address speech broadly, because if you basically just say free speech doesn't matter, free speech doesn't matter, free speech doesn't matter, except right here, then I don't know if you're going to really mobilize people into caring about it right here, right? In the instances where it should matter. And I think that sort of problem arises from the fact that the left just doesn't want to talk about free speech generally, and that they only care about these types of laws in the context of pointing out the hypocrisy of people on the right. But, like, I do think that the left should have a very robust defense of free speech, and I just don't see it ever.
You don't see it ever?
No, I don't. Do you see it?
Well, I consider myself somewhere in there, and free speech means the world to me. The world to me. And so
feel lonely these days, though? Or do you not feel isolated in these thoughts?
Well, let me ask you, as somebody that's very much on the left, and how do we get better at talking about this stuff? How can we acknowledge, on the one hand, that something has changed and is changing, and to try to understand what it is without becoming grist for somebody's political propaganda?
This might be naive, right? But I just think that people are freaking out too much about it right now, you know? Like, I don't think that somebody talking about these issues, like, you know, whether professors are scared or whatever, or whether or not, like, you know, this particular cancellation was just or not.
Right.
Like, I think that when people just say, well, it's all going to lead to X world, you know, or democracy is over if we have this conversation, like, I think they those people need to calm down a little bit, you know? And I think it's a form, I do think at some level, for some of those people, it is a form of bullying in a way, right? Like, it's a form of bullying to say, you don't get to talk about this, or I'm going to ascribe the worst possible consequences to what you just said. And I don't know. I don't believe that. You know, I think that we can have these conversations as adults, and that, you know, most people will think about them in a thoughtful manner, and that the number of people who try and actually weaponize speech in that this sort of way, like, I don't know, like, you know, it's mostly politicians and everything. So why can't we as citizens and, like, writers and thinkers, you know, have these conversations? Like, I think we can.
Jay Caspian King, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can read some of Jay Caspian King's reporting at newyorker.com, and he's on the opinion page of the New York Times.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.